Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Achtung, Achtung, or is it alarm, alarm? I can't remember. John, good to see you.
You too, Al. How's it going?
Great. And James, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you.
This week on the last chat you did for the podcast was about setting the scene for 1944 in the Pacific, right?
Yes.
And I thought I wanted to be a bit tangential this week, sort of to chew the cud, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Always.
Because as I lay on my lounger,
in the sun, the sun beating down,
groaning, a belly full of all inclusive, did I want another mimosa? We got sent the sort of roundup of 25 pages actually of emails. From listeners, all of them complimentary, so clearly there's been some weeding gone on.
Our bribery efforts have really paid off now.
That's exactly. Garhanger are good to us. But basically, there was a really, really interesting an email from a listener called Adam Prestwich. The way he talks about what he does and how it reflects on some of what we talked about, I wanted to sort of throw out there so we could talk about this. He said, so, hi chaps. Just wanted to drop a note after listening to a recent How to Win a War episode, which covered an overview of some of the logistics, elements and considerations. This is a topic I've also been fascinated in, as professionally I'm a manufacturing engineer. And I've always wondered how some of the processes I'm familiar with today were enacted in the Second World War. For background, I've spent 25 years working in the automotive supply chain, including Ford Motor Co. and now Jaguar Land Rover. In my experience, a lot of the problems described in that episode are very similar to the problems we face today. What James is describing in the episode was what we call the demand planning cycle and how demand is received from the field and then fulfilled.
Yes.
Typically, you can have what's called a pull system where all the demand comes from the customer and you try and build a responsive system to meet that demand as soon as you can, aka build to order. Or alternatively, you can have a push where you build to stock using forecasted demand from the market. And you then have to sell it, even though it might not be exactly what was desired. There's a trade-off between precision, give the customer what they want, and time to deliver between these two approaches. Even today, with modern demand planning and forecasting digital tools, this is unbelievably difficult. If you have a steady demand with low variation in the product complexity, this is where Henry Ford's "you can have any color you like as long as it's black" comes in. In the Second World War context, does that mean that means you want your batch of Shermans to be as big as possible and all of the same level of design? This then causes a conflict with the customer who wants a continually better tank. I mean, he goes on, but it's such an interesting point, such an interesting way of looking at it. Because he then also, God bless him, says, because of the lead times in ordering products and raw materials, this all has to be done months and months in advance, which is another explanation for Al's theory the Allies are always 6 months behind being able to do what they truly want to do. So,
yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So, John, I mean, for instance, the Sherman tank is sort of the glowing example of this. Mm-hmm. You know, its virtue is it's mass produced. its virtue is it's that's a push product, isn't it? Where that the US industry is building up a great stock of them and then trying to spread them out all over the world. But then by the end of the war, you see that there are variants and there's a need for the market for a higher caliber weapon or a more robust suspension, then pushes in the other way back. Who's doing this? who's this going through? I mean, obviously a big component in is reports from the front saying this tank starts the third time when it's cold rather than the first time. How's that big feedback being driven and what's going on?
Yeah, so you've got observer reports, mainly through Army ground forces that are happening throughout the entire war. They're quite fascinating, actually. And it's usually people with some serious rank, lieutenant colonels and colonels, who are attached to commands. And I always wonder what the dynamic was, because, I mean, these could be COs in waiting, and I'm sure many of them wanted to be in command of troops. Instead, General McNair, Lieutenant General McNair, who heads up Army ground forces, is sending them all over the globe to give this feedback on operations. So from an historian's point of view, it's great stuff, because you're getting that really on site. Here's how people and things are performing kind of assessment. So in terms of who's doing the adjustments and where that kind of sort of what I guess we'll call it blowback from the customer is coming from, it's there. In terms of the actual production, I mean, that's a much more complex answer. I mean, if we had as you were talking about the push side of this, if we had responded to that, we'd end up with the M1 Abrams. Is all I could sit here and think of, because I mean, it's the classic example, isn't it, of the push side, right? I mean, that's exactly what the customer wants. The problem, of course, is the damn thing has to be shipped, and that's a serious problem. So for the Sherman, I mean, everything is really has to be dictated by that and conform to it. And on the doctrinaire side and the ordnance development side and the vehicle development side, that's been in the works for years, even before the U.S. is in the war. All of this kind of, you know, deep dive-ish exploratory, here's what we may need in the next war kind of stuff. And so, you know, the Office of War Plans and all this kind of stuff is or the War Planning Division, whatever the term is appropriate, is taking that into consideration as it's coming up with grand strategy too. But really, in terms of practicality, it's McNair's Army ground forces that end up having to deal with this as the war really unfolds.
And one of the interesting things about the Sherman tank, of course, is that it's 30 tons. And even once you've got your chickens and extra logs of wood and piano, five guys in it. And
the piano you've stolen.
And piano you've stolen and the squeeze box and all the rest of it. It's still under 40 tons, which is, of course, is essential if you're on the attack. Because if you're on the attack, your enemy is going to blow up every bridge that you come across. And the most common and easiest way to bridge it is to put a Type 40, Class 40 Bailey Bridge on it, which obviously takes 40 tons. So if you've got something that's heavier than 40 tons, it ain't going to work. So you don't want a massive great tank at that stage of the for much of the war, because you haven't got the bridging that can cope with it. There's all these other factors that come into play,
aren't
there?
That's self-fulfulfilling, though, isn't it? You've got that. I mean, which is the chicken and the egg in the Sherman tank?
But again, you've gone down the road of going, well, the class 40 is the perfect you know bridge for us to use. Uh-oh, we've got comets now, and we've got...
So we now need
a class 60. You can't just sort of click your fingers and change that. That's the problem.
So what is the chicken and the egg with the tank and the bridge, John? The Bailey Bridge is a British innovation. So that's the tail wagging the dog there is actually British rail loading gauges that dictates the size and scope of what British tanks can be, even down to how big a gun they can fit in their turret, which then dictates the bridge, which then feeds back to a Sherman tank.
And that goes back to the Road Traffic Act of 1930.
It's the Road Traffic Act of 1930. But railway gauges go back before Brunel.
Well, and the other thing that's really interesting is if you go to the continent, you step up onto the train, up onto the carriage. But in British railway design, station design, yes, the platform is parallel with...
It's level with the train, yeah.
So you can't have anything that's wider than the width of the carriage, whereas in continent, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just amazing. Yeah. When
it's a small things.
It.
Yeah, small
exactly.
Things.
Just a little thing like that. How that's going to affect your design and everything else.
But I tell you what I was thinking about. The development of Rolls-Royce and axial flow jet engines. So the Rolls-Royce Avon engine, which is still being used into the 1970s and which powers numerous jets into the 50s and 60s, is developed in 1944. And it's first capable of going into a into an aircraft and operating a flying an aircraft, I think, in 1946, so the year following the war. Maybe 1947, but it's literally just after. But it is developed in 1944. And the interesting thing about jet development in Britain is that there is no urgency whatsoever. There's an urgency in so much that, you know, no one wants to kind of be dragging their heels on this stuff. But there's not an urgency, we've got to get it in quick before the war's over. So they take their time over it. Whereas the German jet engines, the UMO engines that they use in the ME262, for example, is really badly built.
But they're hurrying it through
because there's an urgency to it.
Well, and they're simpler to make than piston engines.
They are.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
But they've got a 20-hour shelf life. Whereas the British, because they're doing quite fine with what they've got, their Tempests and Spitfires and Lancasters and all the rest of it, and what the American arsenal is, they don't need to hurry up the jet technology,
the development
of the jet.
Well, and when the American jet fighter arrives, it's slower than a Mustang anyway. Ironically, I mean, one of the things that also comes into this, though, and I think it's interesting, Jim, you've tipped into the Germans here, is one of the things the Americans have control over or control of is the quality of their raw materials and their steel and stuff in a way that the Germans don't. We've got Masters of the Air coming up, and I've just read Don Miller's Mighty Eighth, a Master of the Air, in preparation for watching the program and talking about the program. And he talks about, you know, the distorting effect on German fighter production of the combined bomber offensive in truth, and then, you know, the attempts to sort of knock out ball bearings, and the attempts to knock out oil, synthetic oil production, and all that, you know, and then eventually to knock out the Reichsbahn and coal, all these attempts to pull levers to disrupt the German economy. And the thing that the Americans never have to face is that kind of molestation of their industrial base. And I think that's really fascinating. Is that even then, even when your factories are, you still have supply chain problems. You still have, you know, not being able to quite give the customer in the field what he wants. Even when your factories aren't being bombed on a regular basis. And again, it led me to then thinking about, you can marvel at German fighter production all you like, but just think how much easier they'd had it if there hadn't been a strategic bomber offensive. How more smoothly their industry would have run, and that everything they're doing.
Yeah, because it's not particularly convenient to have to build a factory in the middle of a mountain. It's really not. In a remote corner.
Basically, you know, your labor done by slaves. I mean, you know, that is not ideal, is it? You know, I mean.
No, it really isn't.
It's horrible.
So the first ME262s. So basically, they were built on this mountain. Then they were put. But the problem is you're then nowhere near
an airfield.
Yeah.
So they then have to create a lift that goes to the top of the mountain. And they level out this airfield on this airstrip on the top of the mountain. Yeah. But the problem is, it's not really long enough for it.
Yeah.
But at least you're going off a mountain, so you've got a bit of drop. It's a bit like going off an aircraft carrier. So what they had to do is they had to put this extra boost on them and almost no fuel, because otherwise it'd be too heavy, which would give them the kind of enough to take off and 50 miles worth to get to the nearest airfield where they could probably be landed.
And no one has flown jets before.
And no one's flown jets before.
Yeah, by the way, we've never done this.
So
good luck.
To say this is inconvenient is kind of massively understating.
It is. It's crazy.
Yeah. When it comes to steel, there's never a point where the Americans think they're going to run out, is there?
Not to my knowledge. Interestingly enough, we do after the war because of a strike, and this actually affects the repatriation program of bringing home the war dead, because they're all supposed to be in steel caskets, and that process gets held up for, I don't know, about 9 months or something like that because of a steel strike, and there's also a railway strike. Which also here's how everything fits together, which is why this is so fascinating. There was a lot of residual resentment of organized labor coming over from the war because, you know, unions had gone on strike, returning soldiers resented that. And so you have the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, which really curtails the power of labor unions and allows the president to slap an injunction on any strike he feels endangers national safety or health, which could be a railway strike. So, I mean, we're not really in danger of running out of the, you know, all the resources we need to make the steel, but we have our own internal problems that affect the availability of steel. And this was kind of happening during the war, too, because of those, you know, aforementioned strikes, that you have a coal miner strike or, you know, something like that, that really does affect the war effort. So we introduced that element to it as well. Much less, I should point out, too, our racial strife, which at times is going to cause problems with the perpetuation of production because of riots or labor discord or whatever else it will be. So it's interesting because the Germans have their problems, which, of course, are existential and much more serious. But even a secure country like the U.S. has some level of problems that affect, I guess, what is produced, what gets where, and all these other things we're talking about.
Yeah, and I suppose it extends. This happens in Britain too. So there's plenty of striking going on, and it doesn't go down very well.
Well, it was striking. There was coal miners striking, I think, March 1944.
Yeah,
Bet the soldiers were thrilled with that, right?
Yeah, it doesn't go down well at the front.
People aren't
delighted with that. But then I suppose it's nevertheless going to be a necessary function if you expand your economy out of nowhere and you take a load of men out of it. Mm-hmm. Take a load of labor out of it. You're empowering labor. Mm-hmm. It's part of the problem there, isn't it? And appeals to patriotism only run so far, don't they? If people think they can make
so, for
it.
Sure, it runs as far as your checkbook. I mean, it's and the other thing too is you'd seen a very pro labor administration.
Yeah.
You know, in the 1930s, that's still in there in the 1940s. You had the Wagner Act in 1935, which was extremely pro-labor. It's part of the New Deal.
Yeah.
So there was kind of that expectation, I think, in labor. So this is mind-blowing. When FDR takes over in 1933, there's 3 million members of labor unions. By the time he dies in 1945, there's 14.8. So, I mean, like you said, the power of labor unions is really growing, just out of sheer size in this case, but also they could see the influence that they had, how badly the country needed them. And so then this creates social tension, which I think is quite fascinating. Because if I'm sitting in a foxhole and I'm getting paid $21 a month as a private, and that steel worker or whatever is back home living under his own roof, secure with 3 meals and making good money, and then he goes on strike, how am I going to feel about that when my life is on the line?
You
understand that. And yet the labor union argument is, hey, soldier, we're in the same fight here against the industrialists, against the capitalists, against, you know, those who have exploited us and those who are sending you to your death for whatever, you know, we're fighting for, you know, whatever it is. The other interesting thing, too, labor. This shows how sort of kind of hard left some of the labor unions were. Many of them were determined not to really participate in the mobilization that we already have in 40 and 41 until the Soviet Union is in the war. And then the mindset completely changes. So the political side is certainly.
Well, I mean, there are tensions in the UK around that, although what would you'd call like mainstream labor come into government in order to gather respectability from being part of a coalition government in 1940. But there are still people who, you know, you're sort of Morning Star people who are not interested in joining the war effort, are they? Until Barbarossa happens, and suddenly they have to change sides again, having changed sides in 1939 against fighting fascism. I mean, what the interestingly, to go back to Adam's email, he makes the point. He says, I appreciate that some people might not find this is a sexy topic, but I think we're pretty hot for it right now.
Yeah, very hot for it.
But he says, I think it's really fundamental to understanding how the war got done. Not only that, impact continued post-war. As an example, I don't think it's a coincidence that a substantial proportion of modern manufacturing philosophy and thinking came from Japan in the 50s and the 60s. Mm. So he thinks that
but who's influencing Japan?
Because they lose, because they can't make manufacturing work for them. And so they, in the 50s, they have a complete rethink and look at how the Americans have done it and look at how actually you learn the lessons of push-pull supply manufacture.
Well, I've been talking about this book I've been reading, Judgment at Tokyo, by Gary Bass, and which is amazing, about the Tokyo war trials in 46 to 48. He makes the point that literally the only country that works, you know, functions really successfully out of all this is Japan.
Well, there's something to think about. We'll take a break. We'll be back in a second.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to We Have Ways to Make You Talk, USA, with John McManus and James Holland and myself, Al Murray. And
well, I should,
Jim just threw a big one in our laps there, didn't he?
Well, I meant in Southeast Asia. I mean, in Asia.
The losing sides.
Well, no, because it works quite well in West Germany, doesn't it? But
well, I don't know. I think Germany's in a rotten, a terrible state for at least 2 or 3 years. I mean,
by the sixth. Oh yeah, yeah. Federal Republic of Germany is a success.
And Italy's a success, isn't it? Into the 1950s and stuff. Gary Bass is talking about, you know, in Southeast Asia. He's also said, you know, the Philippines, you know, Indochina, Vietnam, China.
Yeah.
You know, China. You know, while this trial is going on, you've got a Chinese judge there, and there's a Chinese civil war going on at the same time. But you've got a Russian judge there. By the end of the trial in 1948, you've got the Berlin Airlift. Yeah. You know, you've got this judge sitting alongside French, British, and American.
The fact that the French get a seat on the UN Security Council is interesting in itself.
Yes,
that comes the Second World War.
Well, but they also have an Indian judge.
They
have an Indian judge at the Tokyo trial. Yeah. They do. And he's a scholar from Bengal as well as being a lawyer. So he's an academic as well as a lawyer. And he's the last state saying, well, we need an Indian, and lots of other people don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And he goes in, and he's been a loyal Raj servant. And at the end of it, he just goes, you're all absolutely, this is a shower. We should exonerate the whole lot. I'm not going for it. And
really?
Only 7 out of the 11 judges vote in favour. 4 drop out, including the Dutch one. Well, and so the Americans are leading with it, and the whole ideal is that you have this kind of, you know, you're not holding nations to account, you're holding war criminals to account, so that the nation can then get on with things. And this works brilliantly for Japan. The caveat, of course, is that the person who's absolutely most guilty of all is the guy who stays in power, which is Emperor Hirohito, because it's on his watch, right?
And others,
if he's the emperor,
others connected to him. And this is really the troubling thing, is that it's selective. The justice is very selective in post-war Japan.
Exactly, that's the point. But it works really well, is the bottom line.
For Japan, it does.
For Japan, it does, almost uniquely. But for everyone else, it's just total turmoil and mayhem and done to a backdrop of partition in India and millions being killed in India and Pakistan as Pakistan emerges. Of the civil war in China, another 20 million killed or whatever it is. I mean, it's just astonishing.
In August 1945, from an Asian point of view, the war is just beginning.
Yeah. That's definitely the case. Yeah. The Second World War... I mean, it's interesting. We spoke to Jonathan Fennell before Christmas, and he's about to write a three-volume Second World War, and it, which ends at the end of the Chinese Civil War, doesn't it? Is where he's saying it ends. And I think he's starting in 1931, or he may even be starting in 1917. I don't know.
Or maybe 1900. I mean, who knows?
It goes. Waterloo. You can always start at Waterloo.
Waterloo. American War begins there.
American War of Independence. Yeah. Why not?
I'm going to begin with the arrival of
the Big Bang. Yeah. I mean, it's
yeah.
1759 in Quebec.
Storm those heights. It's a fascinating argument, and I mean to me it's a very kind of Western point of view to think of August 14th, 15th, 1945 as the end of the conflict. It's really the beginning of the conflict on some levels, and actually even from a Western point of view it is, in the sense that we're going to get involved, the U.S., in two major wars on the Asian continent. In the 1950s
Korea and
the
Vietnam.
1960s, and obviously Britain.
And that's all because of involvement in the Second World War, right?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, you know, the British are involved in Korea, not Vietnam. But you know, the point still stands that it's really the beginning for all of us on some levels. And that's part of what really attracted me to the idea of doing the trilogy about the Army in the Pacific Asia Theater, because to me there's a lot more lessons to be learned from the war against Japan than the war in Europe, which in some respects is a one-off, smiting Nazism, restoring stability to the European order, and then fortunately no war happens there at a larger scale level until 2022, which even then, you know, doesn't involve Western Europe in terms of actual combat. You know, so I really think that the Asia Pacific side gives us kind of more windows to the future, and also the kind of fighting. It's not Geneva Convention kind of stuff that we're going to have from then.
It's America's two geopolitical faces, isn't it? Because you know, the European War in a way, European wars in a way, are a legacy of America's origins as a state, aren't they? As a modern state. That it's inhabited by European people, essentially, who bring European history and interest with them. I mean, although obviously America's full of people who've run away from Europe, you can see why they might not want to go back there and get involved in the fighting.
Well, and that's
again.
The mindset. That's the disgust World War One among whites.
Exactly.
I was saying, but we're disgusted with it, and here they go again, and we don't want any part of it. You know, that is certainly the white point of view.
But then inevitably, the Pacific is America's geopolitical destiny, rather than its sort of historic geopolitical destiny. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what MacArthur is kind of arguing during World War II. Is he saying this is our future? And I think that there's some level of truth to that. But I think he was far too dismissive of the importance of Europe, and he will be during the Korean War as well, when he has this sort of patronizing, "Here we fight Europe's war." You know, when he's saying that in 1950. In 51, it's like, oh my gosh, it's all linked in some ways, but there's no question that the American future, you know, lay in Asia and the Pacific.
In the 20th century, I suppose you could argue that America occupies Germany until 1990 or something, but is even still there.
Yeah.
even today, how many years fighting does America do in the Pacific in the 20th century? If you tot it all in East Asia, if you tot it all up,
if we total it all up, post World War II, there's the 3 years of the Korean War, and I guess I'm not counting that post 1953 period when there's a lot of tension. And we're going to keep substantial forces there. So there's some fighting that happens on the DMZ, whether it's, you know, 1968, whether it's in the 70s or whatever. So I'm, you know, discounting that in a way. But Vietnam, when does that amp up and when does it end? Well, I mean, let's just say 1961 to 75 in terms of
a long time, some level of loss of life
and presence there. That's a heck of a long time. And then, by the way, let's take it forward and talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, which, by the way, are on the Asian landmass. Okay, so that is going to add a lot more years, two more decades. And how long did we fight in Europe? Really, if you get down to it, only one or one and a half. But yes, we're involved in the war from 1941, the end of 41 on. Yeah, but ground troops fighting on actual European soil. Well, that really begins July 10th, 1943,
and
it lasts less than 2 years, although it's episodic. You know, and really the core of it is June 1944 through the end of the war in Europe. There's fighting, and then there's presence. we've had to have presence ever since. And that really, you know, and I think that's what's fascinating about D-Day. From my point of view, just, you know, as an American and a U.S. historian, in some ways, this is the beginning to me of NATO, of a U.S.-led NATO. And that is what we carry forward. And so it's like, okay, what's brought them together? Well, I think it's a shared set of values on some levels, right? And that applied against Nazi Germany, it'll apply against communism, it'll apply against Putin's Russia, I hope. You know, it's that shared set of values that has undergirded NATO on that side of the house, but you also kind of see this in Asia and the Pacific too.
What's extraordinary about bad Ukraine at the moment is that the figures of the Russians are losing is kind of, you know, the Second World War scale.
And I don't know how they can sustain that.
Hundreds of thousands.
How can they sustain that when they're not the Soviet Union anymore with all these republics and all these buffer zones and all the resources?
It's, you know, they're apparently making 100 T-80s every month.
I mean,
old tractor factories converted, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's
beyond my level of understanding, I guess. But
there'll be a push-pull manufacturing delivery problem.
There absolutely will.
Just to give it full circle.
About shipping.
Well, the factories are pushing T-80s
because they're easier to make.
And the front are saying we could do something a bit more up to date, please.
Yeah,
we're having
that will be exact thing that we were talking about will be happening. Mm-hmm. Will be happening right now, and it'll be there's a kind of like it or lump it thing, I suppose. When a war's up on its feet, because after all, you look at the M1 Abrams, products of Cold War. Military development; those pieces of technology. They're not only designed; they're designed for a consumer who isn't just the U.S. Army, but they're designed for congressmen who have who really wouldn't mind a big expensive factory in their state.
Exactly what they're designed for. That's precisely.
You know, you look at the development of the F-35 is completely driven by. You know, isn't it fantastic that this $50 million plane is built. In your constituency. Mm-hmm. I mean, what else do you want? And it could do everything as well. So you don't have to build lots, you just build those ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a pork barrel aspect to it.
Absolutely.
Which after all doesn't apply if you've got a war up and running, because the pull of the battlefield, the demand of the battlefield is that the tanks don't have to. I mean, 'cause the other thing for instance is, you know, Challenger 2 has lasted 25 years as a design. How long was the Comet around for in the British Army?
I mean, nothing.
9 months, start to finish. and excelled on the... Actually, arrived at the battlefield too late. Was overspecced for the battlefield that it arrived on by that time. And then they didn't make any more. Whereas, you know, if you build a Cold War vehicle, it's got to last forever.
Oh, it does. V-52, 60-some-odd years.
Exactly. A Second World War tank might last, 3 weeks? So if it breaks down twice in 3 weeks, that's not so bad. If you've got a Cold War tank, it breaks down twice in 3 weeks, it doesn't matter.
But the other thing that I find absolutely amazing is at what point did they think, okay, so we got, we know we need lots of Sherman tanks. We know at some point we're going to go into Europe. But what point are they going, when we put in all these tanks, we're going to need lots and lots of trucks. We're going to need trucks of different sizes, so we're going to need lots and lots of those. Hang on a minute, we've got a civilian truck. Let's just kind of change the body shape a little bit, but the axle's the same. You know, the chassis is basically the same, engine's the same, but we'll just kind of change it a little bit, have thicker rubber tires, and that kind of stuff. So they're making that decision, but they're also making the decision about, okay, we're going to need cranes that we can put on ships, but we're going to need cranes that we can then put onto the port, because sometimes we're not going to be landing on a beach. We are actually going to have a port, such as Anzio or Nettuno or Taranto or whatever. We're going to need cranes, so they've got to come over from America. We're going to need graders because we're going to have it where air power is absolutely key to it.
Everywhere we go.
So we're going to need bulldozers because we're firepower heavy. And it's fine in Tunisia, but southern Tunisia around Gafsa, not a lot to kind of, a lot of buildings to worry about. But you know, we get into Europe, you know, that's going to be quite heavy. So we're going to need bulldozers and so on. But at what point are they having the foresight to realize that that's what it, and this presumably is because the original intention of the Americans when they come in is to go straight across the channel, so they're already thinking, okay, so what are we going to find when we get to France? So although they actually then go to Tunisia and they don't need all that stuff there, they're kind of, hang on a minute, we've already prepped for this stuff, we're going to need it when we go into Sicily, we're going to need it when we go into Italy, and we're going to need it when we go into across the channel in June
Well, and the other thing we're going to need, which is the ultimate unglamorous vehicle, but the unsung hero, the armored world, the recovery vehicle. That vehicle that recovers our tanks that got bogged down or through a track or whatever. So we're going to need that. And so where does all this, I'm simplistically saying this, but it's basically the military professionals have had this concept on the books, these concepts on the books in the interwar period. You know, the Eisenhowers of the world or whatever. And then once
they've been thinking about this already,
they've been thinking about it and thinking ahead and arguing among themselves, especially like at the war college level, the command and general staff college level, the war plans level, all that stuff that the average citizen would have recoiled from and saying these warmongers are planning for a future war. So all this is really under the radar. And it's a very small insular
world. Yeah, because at some point, someone's got to be sat around. Someone's got to be sat around a table going, guys, listen, I've been thinking about this. You know, we're worrying about tanks, but we're going to need bulldozers. We're going to need graders. We're going to need all this other stuff as well. And everyone goes, God, you know what? You're right. I mean, is it that conversation, surely. I mean, that conversation has to have happened at some point. At some point, someone's got to say it for the first time.
And exactly. Or they're writing about it, you know, in a war college paper or something like that. Right. And then this then combines with the more pragmatic side of 40 and 41 of thinking ahead. Like you said, Jim, we're going to need these kind of vehicles. How do we retool our industry? Where will they be? How does it all work? How will we ship it? They're starting to work through those problems. And then, of course, when the U.S. gets in the war, then it all becomes even more pragmatic. But really, a year before Pearl Harbor, we're mobilizing for war on a pretty major level, even to the point of having a draft, obviously. It seems to me the problems that have to be worked out post Pearl Harbor are all of shipping and all of like how you retool the manufacturing base in the most efficient way. You know, the manufacturing base that's already there. And this is what Americans kind of wring their hands over nowadays is, would we have the manufacturing base now to face a peer enemy, you know, after having, you know, outsourced a lot of our manufacturing over the course of decades to other countries? Would we have that capability now the way we did in World War II, that intrinsic industrial strength that we had? And I think that's a very good question. But even in World War II, it was a really tough transition.
The one thing that the Germans don't have is lots of bulldozers and graders. I mean, they just don't have any of this stuff.
Exactly. And the Soviets don't have it too, and we have to give it to them. And there's only a few countries that do have that. It's U.S., Britain, Canada, maybe Australia to some extent.
Full stop.
And that's a big part of the sinews of war. Especially if you want to make armored warfare, or if you want to make, you know, like the British and the Americans are doing, strategic bombing. I mean, that's just not a matter of just sending those bombers up there. It's having all the maintenance and all the stuff, right?
But then also the bomber people are in competition with the army people and that before the war, as you say, this is all theoretical. I mean, it's more involved than back of the envelope planning, but essentially it's the bomber people saying, we're going to need this. That the army people say, we're going to need that. The tension between that politically, quite extraordinary. The sort of, you know, that Mitchell ends up in court, doesn't he?
Well, because he's so incendiary. If he had just been like, hey, you know, in the future, this is the way we should defend our coasts, and we really need to be prioritizing. Instead, he's saying they're committing treason, you know, at high levels.
Once you're
that incendiary, that's why he's end up on trial. And MacArthur, by the way, was on his jury and knew Mitchell pretty well, actually, but actually we all know who the golden boys are on this side of the Atlantic, and I think on yours as well, of who gets priority. It's the aviators, and we go down that road, don't we? And then we find out we're gonna have to fight this war on the ground.
But there's also very good reasons for doing that in the 1930s. The whole point is to try and sort of, you know, so that you don't have hundreds of divisions of infantry. You know, it's inherently inefficient to have 300 infantry divisions.
Well, and it's socially disruptive.
If you've got 300 infantry divisions,
right?
Not an efficient use of your manpower,
and politically unacceptable.
That's what I mean.
If there's 30 infantry divisions, you're basically, or 300 infantry divisions, you're saying there's going to be a million casualties again.
Well, and you're drafting millions of guys, including maybe even old guys like us.
but what the Allies work out in the 1930s is actually, yes, it's politically it's unacceptable, socially it's unacceptable. But also, it's just not an efficient use of manpower. Mm. Not in a technological modern world where you've got an alternative means of hammering your enemy.
But interestingly, what we're talking about there is the, in a way, is the push-pull of the supply chain of the political supply chain. Is that there might be what politics wants to do, and then there's what society's prepared to do, and can the politicians pull the market towards fighting a war in a certain way, or will it be pushed in another direction by society? And, you know, American political society American society is pushing the political establishment away from a war for the whole of the interwar period, while Roosevelt is trying to pull the market, as it were, towards accepting there's going to have to be one. And in a strange way, these things are they're reflections of each other, aren't they? You know, everything's a supply chain in a way, and there's a political supply chain, isn't there? And whether a politician can get out of the society what he wants, or whether the society can get out of the politician what they want, is the thing that's in permanent tension. And when you come to a question like a global war, those things come right to the front of where the discussion sits and what you're capable of, actually what you're able to do. I mean, it's interesting, Jim, you talked earlier about John, you mentioned has America currently got the sort of manufacturing? I mean, we can't make tanks anymore.
Well, we can make 100 Challenger 3s in 3 years. Probably not.
Well exactly. That's what we just can't do it anymore.
No, we can't. We should be able to, though. It's ridiculous.
That's the same current climate.
Yeah. I think we know for sure we can't. Whereas, you know,
we're wringing our hands America thinking we can't, but not 100% sure, well, I guess.
You can turn out $1 billion stealth jets that, you know.
I've got a final thought on this. When Roosevelt says in 1940, I want us to be able to build 50,000 aircraft in a year. Everyone falls off their seats.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Everyone just goes, what? Yeah. And I think it's one of the most brilliant pieces of politics of the entire Second World War, because everyone goes, that's insane. That's mad. That's at a scale that no one has ever even thought about before. And then suddenly everyone starts to go, hang on a minute. And this might be possible. And suddenly, almost overnight, it becomes a new normal. And suddenly America starts thinking, wow, we can do this on a kind of monster scale. Because what you're talking about, aircraft, applies to tanks, applies to dozers, it applies to ships, applies to everything. And also, more importantly, the Germans go batshit when they hear this, because they go, oh, that's insane.
Goering says they can't do that. They can make toasters.
Exactly. They retreat into their racist ideology to explain why we can't do it.
But when he's saying that, he's also going, yikes.
Yeah. Internally, he's like, oh my God, they may actually do this. And I think it's a great moment. I agree,
and
it becomes, Jim.
And when you have these shocking moments in politics, and, you know, let's face it, America's had a few of them recently. Something that seems so completely outrageous and abnormal on Tuesday suddenly becomes normal by Friday.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the key point about the 50,000 aircraft.
And this in a positive way.
It's laying down a gauntlet, but it's also, it's suggesting a scale of ambition which no one else has thought of. Then suddenly becomes actually the new benchmark. Yeah. And that's a game changer.
But also, to be a, you know, party pooper, I mean, you could argue that the conclusion the British draw at the end of the Second World War is that central planning is the way to move things forward, and that turns out to not be quite right.
Definitely not.
Whereas America concludes that turbocharged military industrial complex at the top of manufacturing is the way to then create a colossal consumer boom that not only maintains your power as the world's predominant power, but will sustain it and take it right into a sort of science fiction future of going to the moon.
Well, absolutely, because in war, in conflict, but as in in civilian life, you're going to need dozers and graders and ships.
Yeah.
You might not need so many tanks after a while, but you're still going to need a lot of the things that you're producing. Yeah. The technical know-how that you've learned from your military expansion can be applied to all sorts of things.
Well, there's no question. And so, I mean, to build on your point, you have these presidential moments of great aspirations. Roosevelt with the aircraft, right. Kennedy going to the moon. I mean, it's linked in that sense, isn't it? Because the second isn't possible without the first happening, and creating this sense we can do big things. And like you said, the production that we've had during the war, the know-how that we've gotten, especially on the aviation side, that now makes space possible. The technology transfer, shall we put it politely, that we've had at the expense of the Germans after World War II, yeah. Right? The Wernher von yep. Braun's of the world and all that too has contributed as well. So yeah, interesting theme.
Well, I mean,
that's some pretty big stuff for first episode up.
So yeah, thanks, Adam Presswich. Thanks, Adam Presswich, for that email that stimulated that chat.
Really thoughtful job. Email. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, and there's lots more of it. Not that it wasn't all good. It was all great, but there was lots more of it. you want to hear what we think, primarily, if you listen to this. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, John. Lovely to see you. We will see you all again very soon. 1944, big year. Lots to talk about.
Lots to
cheerio.
Talk about. See ya.
Bye-bye.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.